With your help, we can continue to fight for freedom. This is not possible without your generosity. Join our quest for the truth and our freedom. Simply visit www.realitycheck.radio/donate to make a difference today.
Here on Reality Check Radio, it's Real Talk with Rodney Hyde. One of the things you learn in Parliament is that it's not a meritocracy, which is to say the people at the top aren't necessarily the smartest or the best or the most moral. Quite the reverse. In fact, it's a very tough place for any person of conviction and principle. And I say this because we often look upon politicians who get elected out as something went wrong or they didn't go all the way, but actually they're often very good MPs. And I'm very fortunate. You're going to enjoy this. We've got along former MP. I hate that word because that's how I get described. Simon O'Connor, who was the MP for Tamaki, for National, and was released from service at the last election. Good morning, Simon.
Good morning. I'm loving this already, Rodney.
Have you got over the hurt?
I have, and absolutely, actually. In fact, by about 8:15 on election night, I remember turning to my wife and I said, we've lost. And it was almost for both of us that a switch was turned. So, yeah, you still feel a bit hurt. There's that rejection. But for those who know me, I'm actually deeply philosophical and deeply stoical. So I just sort of switched. It's like, right, I'm back home, reintroduce myself to my family.
Because it's got to end sometime. Mm-hmm. And it is, I felt the same. Because you knew it's going to end, and you, at times you think, I wonder how this I can get out of this, because, you know, you sort of, and then it ends, and I was okay with it too. Tell me, was it not unexpected for you, or was it a surprise?
It was something I had anticipated could happen. So I didn't think it was going to happen, and I wasn't expecting that it would not happen. And I'm not trying to be a former politician here. In fact, as you know, there's nothing quite as former as a former politician. But no, it was something I had anticipated could happen. And it fortunately put me in a good place that night and the subsequent weeks, more for my supporters, members of the party and others who were taken by complete surprise and were deeply upset. And so it actually provided me a good foundation. So I was ready to be able to, I don't know, counsel, talk, chat, console, people, and in some ways fell back to former life and training.
Yes. Tell me, are you still a member of the National Party?
I'm not at the moment. I'm also, I mentioned earlier, being quite philosophical and stoical. Another part of my personality is when things end, I often do very clean breaks. I don't sort of linger or hang around. So things like National Party membership, even involvement in my now former electorate, I've sort of pulled back. I think it's a chance for others to step in.
Mm. You, famous to me in Parliament, stood up and questioned some of the COVID stuff. I remember that speech.
I remember it very well also, partly because it sort of somewhat went viral. People had cut it and used it and edited it in different ways on the internet, and I think it's been one of my biggest shared and viewed videos ever.
Wow. What was your point?
I think the core point is that when, and you can put whatever word you want here, governments, elites, politicians take away people's core and fundamental freedoms, the people will find a way to take it back. And that's what became manifest in New Zealand soon after, obviously with the protests. And I would suggest, Rodney, to you and your listeners, that the continuing resentment in society as people are trying to reclaim the very fundamental rights and freedoms that were taken away from them. And also it was probably as best as I could do in the funny milieu, which was Parliament at the time, to voice my angst and frustration with what was going on.
Did you feel as though you were stepping, you've did it before, you're not a stranger to it, stepping outside of the party story and giving that speech?
I think that actually might be one way to define my political and actually my life today. I'm often stepping outside the norms. I don't follow orders well. I'm someone who wants to know why we're doing what we're doing, and putting it in the political realm, political leader or even a senior colleague telling me we just have to do something doesn't generally cut with me. I need to understand.
You were in the
why.
Army. You were in the army, weren't you?
I briefly was in Wairu learning about military chaplaincy. So I was there for a while, didn't hold commission or anything. I was just there with a Father Julian Wagg, was the then Padre, and spent time with him learning about, obviously, military life to an extent, but certainly being a Padre or a military chaplain.
Not necessarily following orders.
Not necessarily following orders. The great thing about being a chaplain or a Padre in the military is you hold the rank of whoever you're talking to. So in some
really?
Ways you do, yes.
Oh, I didn't know that.
So often a chaplain will go in the army with three pips, so they'll be a captain, but you hold the rank of whoever you're talking to.
If you're talking to a general, you're a general.
In effect, yeah. I mean, you can't give commands, but you're
equals. And, of course, that makes sense because you're there representing God.
Oh, absolutely. And you might be spending time talking to the new recruits, but you're finding just as many conversations with senior officers, you know, often.
Yes.
Your rank doesn't actually apply to what's going on in life.
No, I get that. That's a very, very clever point that the army and military have, because you could be an officer used to giving commands, and then you need to go for solace, someone who will listen to you, someone who can help you, and they can't be a subordinate in the military sense. That's wonderful.
Yeah.
What a wonderful thing.
Yeah,
it's
was
quite
a really
beautiful,
good,
isn't it?
It is. Oh, look, I enjoyed what was a very brief time, but I'd have to say I'd also make a terrible soldier. I wouldn't be following orders very well.
No, well, nor did Charlie Upham, and he got a VC in bar. Tell me, that speech, did you get into trouble with fellow MPs, or was it just glossed over?
I think it was, my memory was more the latter. It was such a confused and weird time that in some ways it slipped under the radar for a lot of colleagues.
As you know, I went to the protest, sadly only for a day. I was 100% on board supporting the protest, and the protest was beat anything I experienced as a politician. It was so amazing. It was just a wonderful thing after all this lockdown and being shut down to sort of do something about it, but to be feeling part of a group. It was a very, very spiritual thing for me, because I understood what humanity was in the protest. But I looked up to that parliament, Simon, and I couldn't understand it. I could understand how, when you're in government or in parliament and a crisis occurs and you're having to make decisions and reassure the public, when you're not really certain what to do and information is lacking, and I can understand getting that wrong. And I'm thinking Mike's big experiences were 9/11, which obviously in a way didn't directly affect us, but we had to make decisions about what to say and do. And then the Christchurch earthquakes, having to make decisions about what to say and do. I was so pleased then not to be Prime Minister in both those instances and having to lead it out front. I was behind the scenes, so to speak. So I could understand at the start of the whole COVID thing, but I couldn't understand as it went on. Tell me what was going on in your words.
Yeah, look, it was a very confused, I'm going generally, happy to talk personally as well, but it was a messy, confused time, too much fear. A lot of stuff comes down, I'd say, to fear, particularly when you think of the likes of COVID, from fear of the contagion itself to fear of family and friends to perceptions to what the media is thinking. And I think it influenced people far too much to the extent that certainly a lot of decision makers became blinkered. I think at the end of the day, the parliament sort of hobbled itself into a particular, almost a singular narrative, and it became an us against them in some ways. When you think about it, that no one chose to go out. And I think that's incredibly unhealthy, to engage, because, you know, the whole point of our democracy, of our parliament, I'm not going to get into etymology of words, you lose all your listeners, but actually it's about drawing people together. And it became an us and them. And it also became a very clear scapegoating dynamic. And I think it's part of the media myth and narrative that's continued since the protests, to try and colour them in a very particular way and to, again, describe them still as the other. And again, innately dangerous. But I think it was not the protests, I mean, but actually the way of treating people as others. But at the time, there was just a lot of confusion. Lots and lots of discussion amongst MPs of what to do. People like myself were and would have been quite prepared to go out and chat, but there was just a general feeling across the parliament and parties that there shouldn't be. And that sort of narrative took hold. And then, you know, to really delve into it, as an individual politician, you've got to make a decision of whether or not this is the particular battle or the particular choice to make and to face the various consequences.
Yeah. And of course, all the way through, where if you're not an egotist like a lot of politicians, you have a sense of humility about what you know. And you never, even when I was at the protest, I wasn't 100% certain about, you know, COVID and the vaccine and all the rest of it. And so I was certain the lockdown was wrong, and I was certain the mandates were wrong. They were policy issues. I always felt they were wrong. But, like, you know, you're feeling your way and trying to judge the data and understand what's going on. And you're dealing with that as well at the time. It's only a complete fool that is confident about these things. I was very impressed by you. And it's very good to hear about that inside of that parliament. And, of course, you would have died on that hill.
Oh, look, my sense, and it's why, you know, different friends, constituents, those who are at the protest, have bumped into a lot as I would go out and get lunch on Lambton Quay or the terrace. The number of people I bumped into who either knew me because of my social media channels or constituents who travelled down would ask, plead, implore for me to get more involved. And, you know, it was always a calculation that had to be made. And I think the big part of it was, and it's probably a very bad analogy, but I didn't want to leap out of the trench effectively by myself, be shot to pieces, and yet hero in inverted commas for 10 seconds and then of no use going forward. So that was sort of my sense that
I
this wasn't the right
that
time.
Perfectly. Tell me, do you think being a man of faith, you looked at the whole COVID fear differently to others?
Possibly. Yeah, I think, so first and foremost, I am a man of faith. Believe it or not, was not always strongly manifest in Parliament. I'd have to go and check my Hansard record, but I can think of one time I've mentioned God, but it's what I'm trying to say here has never been overly explicit about it, believe it or not, but it's always been there. But yeah, I think it does. I don't find myself a particularly fearful
person. Noticed that. I noticed that with through the COVID, that people of Christian faith treated well, there was a lot of Christians at the protest, but they treated people with respect, and they were also placed their faith in God, not government. And I think that helped them see through what was going on. And I was just interested because by nature of being a man of faith, you have belief and principles.
Yeah, and I think I often said in the parliament and elsewhere that the whole point of having, you know, principles or values, or we having things like human rights and freedoms, they exist for the bad times,
yes.
Not the good times. There's no point in being a man of or woman of principle, in, if you will, in good times. It's when you're under pressure that your principles kick in, and the same with things like human rights. They're only there for the good times. And yet when we hit the rocks of the likes of COVID, as a society in general, we tossed them out. And it confused me no end, and it's why things like the speeches, actually did a very long form essay early on in COVID too, drawing out for me a whole lot of the issues that were at. Got more flack for that, I have to say. But yeah, for me, yeah, faith, belief, principles have always been important, and I don't tend to compromise on them readily.
I should explain to listeners that Simon came into Parliament through the door as I went out. So I left Parliament in 2011 election, and Simon came in 2011. So we never overlapped, but I got to meet Simon because my dear mother lived next door to one of his electorate agents, and Simon would pop in, both of whom have passed away, or died, as I prefer to say. Simon, what was your big surprise or insight about being in Parliament that you didn't expect?
Jolly good question. I suppose it'd be two things if I was to try and stretch your question. One is just the absolute desire for some to advance no matter what. Mm. And that goes across all parties, by the way, I suppose. That surprised me, just that naked ambition side for someone, as I perceive myself, as more service-oriented. But probably the most outstanding element was irrationality, that there just was not as much depth of thinking and reason. I really want to stress again to listeners, this goes across all parties. This is not peculiar to the left or the right. Not a lot of reason, or not as much as I expected. And I better say too, Rodney, it's not just within the MPs and the parliament, but even outside, what the different people come in with their wants and needs. Some wonderful times and people, of course, but it was that irrationality of some people that just confounded me.
Yeah. Well, you've lived in an extremely rational world, because training to be a priest is a thinking discipline, and the discipline of studying ideas, critiquing ideas and studying the text. And then you've done years at university with an MA, and so that's years of thinking and criticism and argument. And then you get to Parliament, and it's like, what? Can we discuss this, please? We're doing this. Yeah, but no, I just want it because it seems to me a big mistake. No, we're doing it. It's been decided, or it's just, why are we doing this? And then the craziness, oh, you're bringing it back to me now. I remember being shocked because in a select committee, and indeed in cabinet, you spend an inordinate amount of time over, say, $100 or Jonathan Hunt's taxi chits, and a $1 billion decision just sails through. And I worked it out that people can't relate to $1 billion, and they think, we'll just quickly decide this. But $100 seems a lot of money to them. There's crazy things like that. And big, big decisions can get made in a heartbeat with no analysis. And then other little silly decisions get dragged on and on and on and on. And it can be decided in a room because, oh, it's so-and-so's time to have a win. They will give him the win on this or her the win. It can be, oh, well, we haven't given much to Mary lately, so we'll flick something there. Or, gosh, that was well said. You're clearly passionate about that, so we'll go with that. Or I don't like you, so I'm not agreeing with you no matter what. Or you did me a bad thing in 1953, so I'm never going to agree with you. Or you're not on my team in this caucus. So no. It's that level, isn't it?
It's exactly that level. And without taking away from obviously the absurdities it creates, it's also delightfully human.
Yes.
You know, as you went through that little list, that's not just peculiar to Parliament. You know, it's about anyone who's worked.
It's the human condition.
It is the human condition. But you know, one element you touched on there, decision making that flies through. And I'm obviously not going to mention the specifics. I'd get myself in far too much trouble. But I was surprised at times, or rather, I think the public would be surprised at times, where certain decisions were made in minutes. Usually out of necessity or some massive pressure or reaction. But I wonder too, though, Rodney, part of it, without being too academic, is, and it's like your money analogy, we can conceptualize $100. I struggle to conceptualize $1 billion. And I think it's similar with MPs at times, with big, big decisions. They're too big, they're too challenging. Let's just go with whatever leadership or the advisor says. But I'll quibble over the comma in this sentence.
Yeah. It's a House of Representatives. And then the other thing is, you'd hate it to be rational and cold and technocratic, because it's like the human condition is messy and making decisions is messy. And it's sort of the great thing about a parliamentary democracy, a Westminster system, is it sort of muddles along and is able to self-correct, and you sort of get there. And the other thing I discovered at Parliament, which I loved, was I hadn't realised how valuable it was as a pressure valve, you know, to let pressures that are building up in society sort of blow out and have their say. And again, that was the problem that we had with COVID, because those pressures built up and there was no opportunity for them to let off steam and get heard and get incorporated into the process. It was like you're living under a tyranny.
It's why you ended up with the protests, because and they were inevitable. I mean, easy for me to say here, because it's hard to prove the counterfactual, but it's quite true. I remember saying to colleagues years ago during the early stages that we will end up with protests and we'll end up with violence, because when the governmental and parliamentary side are aligned as a whole, along with media, there was nowhere to express counterpoints constructively. So it was inevitable. It was absolutely inevitable where we ended up. And I would argue still today it's inevitable where we are now, which, coming back to that word I've used before, resented. There's a lot of resentment still in. But that's what I find when I talk to people.
Richard Preble was a great great mentor to me in Parliament. He was a leader of the ACT Party when I was first an MP, and he's very experienced and he's very studied of politics. And his great interest was decision making. And he was very fascinated by how decisions got made. And one of the things that he alerted me to was to always ask, when does a decision have to be made on this? And he observed that sometimes people will have plenty of time to make a decision, like a cabinet or a committee or an individual minister. And they'll make a decision in a heartbeat when they could have actually taken a week or two, right? And then he said other times, you have to make a decision that day and they'll spend weeks over it and make a mess of it. And he said sometimes you don't have to make a decision at all. You can just kick the can down the road. But it's a very interesting, again, a logical thing that It's very easy as a politician in a group to jump to a decision so you can move on. And you're just happy to have decided something, anything, to get moving again and not have actually said, well, hang on, we don't have to decide all of that today. We could decide that Monday. And that's, again, a part of the failure of, you know, that human condition, where sometimes it's just a relief that someone decided something and we can move on. It wasn't me that decided it.
I think that's a very big part of it at times. You know, there's a certain courage which is needed in leadership across any discipline, parliament
huge
or
courage.
Otherwise.
Huge
yeah,
courage.
To be able to say, hold on, I need to say something.
Do you know what people say to me? Oh, you know, it'd be great if you were in parliament. This is in the protest. And if I got the chance and I felt like being truthful, I would say, I'm not sure what I would have decided.
Mm.
Because I know what it's like. You know, it's not that you're bought off or paid off. It's that you're in this pressure cooker and you're making decisions or having to weigh up. Very easy for me to be on the protest side. Very, very tough, I know, if I'd been an MP and I couldn't put my hand on my heart and say, I would have done X. I've never, ever said that. Isn't that funny? I'd like to think I would. It's a bit like, would you be the Dutch person hiding the Jewish family in your attic? It's very easy for us to say, oh, yes, no, I definitely have them in the attic, you know, because I'm a good person. You do not know what you would have done.
Oh, exactly right. In fact, there's far too much sentimentality in our current world where people think they would act in a certain way back in history, and you go, no, probably not. I remember early on, it was probably the most intense time of political life for all MPs, was those early weeks and months of the COVID lockdown as everyone's grappling, particularly as an electorate MP, with what's going on. So lots of people from individuals and families and businesses saying, well, what can we do? But where I was trying to go there is I remember people calling me up and texting me, dobbing in their neighbours for being too close to people or playing in the park just down the way. And I remember one lady calling me to dob in an elderly couple who dared to sit on a park bench on Tamaki Drive. And why I share that is, as someone who loves history, I thought, now I understand the human nature of how you ended up with something like the Stasi in East Germany, where half the population was spying on the other. I never could understand it, to be honest with you, Rodney, when I read history. How on earth could a society end up like this? But here we were within weeks in New Zealand of that fear that I talked about before, and New Zealanders had dobbing in their neighbours. It's like, the human condition. Mm. Yeah, sorry, very long anecdote.
No, it's a perfect anecdote. And, of course, tough for an MP, because while you've got some members in your electorate who are horrified by the lockdowns and the mandates, the bulk of them were all in. You hadn't gone far enough, hadn't done enough. And that's what it's very easy to forget, because the thing is, as an MP, you're actually getting a pretty good sense of the pulse. And the pulse of New Zealand was, look, if they'd said we need to throw the unvaccinated off the cliff, man, half of them would have done it, if you know what I mean. It was that level. And, of course, an MP is sitting there, and that fear has been implanted in the electorate, and you're having to deal with it. And fear is another great thing, right, because you can't reason someone out of it.
That's exactly where I was going to go. That's exactly right.
Once I was scared. Did you enjoy your time as an MP? Are you pleased that you had those 12 years as an MP representing Tamaki?
Love them. Yeah, I love them. I quite honestly, had I woken up in year 2 or 5 or 7 or 10 and had lost the mojo or love of it, I would have left. I enjoyed it. I mean, it has its negative sides. It's intense, as you know, but I overall enjoyed it. I just loved people and ideas.
Yeah. And funny enough, it's not what people expect that you love. Like, everyone, it sounds a bit twee. You say, oh, no, really? I loved going from being a List MP to an electorate MP.
Mm-hmm.
I so loved that because you had an access to government and people could come to you at the end of their tether and you could literally fix it for them.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes you couldn't, and oftentimes they were just happy that you listened or tried. But when you just cut through the nonsense of government sometimes and help someone, and the look in their eyes of heartfelt thanks, and I had to go once to an MP to have help, and I'll never forget it because the help they gave me was life-changing to my life, actually. And you could do that as an MP. That was very, very significant to me. And then the other thing I couldn't get over is how much you learned about New Zealand, because you'd go places and people would open up to you, like they wouldn't open up to you if you weren't an MP, and how much I learned about myself.
Mm. Beautifully. Look, I'd echo just about all of it. I have to say, of all the elements, if you were to try and break political life down, it was the electorate work.
Yeah.
I enjoyed the most. Yeah.
Not so much for you, because you were training to be a priest, so you knew about that service. I had no idea that that would be so rewarding.
Well, people used to often ask me, say, how did you go from priesthood? Not that I was ordained a priest, but as they proceeded, but how did you go from priesthood to public service, political life? It's like, oh, well, in some ways, it's very the same.
Very
same. You debate, you argue, in the best sense of that word, and you're pastoral. You're helping people.
It seems a shame to me now that we have lost that opportunity to go to a priest or a minister with our problems, because I found a lot of people coming to see me in my electorate office were just wanting guidance and help, and they'd choose their local MP because that was someone who had a status and who were available. But I felt that they, in past years, would have had a lot more help from their local church leader.
I tend to agree. I think a lot of our civil institutions, civil institutions are likes of the churches, but I was even thinking the nature of families, as they've deconstructed, there's been a bit of a vacuum or certainly a gap. And so I think you're right. A lot of people used to come to the office, often just for a chat. And it was one of my early learnings, actually, because I'm always someone who wants to fix things.
Yeah.
You come with a problem, and it drives my wife mad because sometimes she just wants to talk about life, and I'm going, right, what do I need to fix? She says, you don't need to fix anything. Just listen.
Just listen.
Yeah. But I learned that through constituents too. It was an ACC case. And I thought, well, at the end of it, I said to the guy, well, what do you want me to do? How can I help? He said, well, you already have. You just listen. He said, there's nothing you're going to be able to do. And he was right.
Isn't that wonderful? No, I got a lot of that.
He just wanted to be heard.
Yeah, yeah. And you learn a lot about yourself because you are always forced to make a decision on very uncomfortable things.
Mm-hmm.
And you find out who you are. And sometimes it's not pretty. I can remember lying in public. Yes.
This is on radio, Rodney. Be careful.
I know. And, you know, I excused the lie in my head because it was to protect another person. I never lied to protect myself. I never lied. But I deliberately, and I remember thinking, this is lying. But it would have destroyed another person. And I actually, I did it a couple of times, but you're a party leader, right? What do you do? And I never thought I would lie. But I did. But I didn't see a way through in good conscience. And I wrestled with it and got to a place. And the great news was I found it so difficult and so hard that I knew that because I was scared that if I got lying, I would stop. You know, it's like, oh, start killing, is keep killing. No, it didn't go like that. But anyway, those sorts of things, or, you know, just when you speak out and when you don't, and you're wrestling with this all the time. Whether you go to the nth degree to help someone or whether you say, look, I've sort of done enough. All those sorts of things are amazing, the twisting and turnings that in ordinary life don't come your way.
Oh, and it's just such an exceptional privilege that people are prepared to share with you their aspects of their life. I mean, it's an extraordinary privilege, and I don't know, triply so that when you consider it, they usually, I used to joke with my team, people don't come to our office to go, hey, just want you to know everything's fantastic. You know, 99% of, they're coming to tell you there's
and problems. I'll be voting for you at the next election.
Oh, yeah, but I always used to laugh at that, Rodney, when people would come in and say, oh, I'll vote for you, or I did vote for you, or some would apologize that they'd voted for Labour. And I was always at pains to say to them, look, it doesn't actually matter to me.
No.
I don't care which way you voted. Yeah. I'm going to help you regardless. And others would say, oh, well, now that you've done this, I'll do this and this voting-wise. It's like, don't care. I'm not doing this in a transactional way. You know, yeah. I'm in a position of influence here, and how can I help?
Well,
and
you I'm so pleased that, and of course it is the nature of you, that you're in such a good space, because I have come across MPs who have left Parliament and got quite down, like they miss it and they feel unfulfilled and feel rejected, and no one can deny that it's a difficult transition back to ordinary life. But it's good to see that you're in such great shape and positive. I want to ask you about your training to be a priest, because I can't imagine this and I want to learn all about it.
I know this is radio, but it's ironic that I'm wearing all black at the moment. So yes. For your listeners to imagine, as we're talking about priesthood, here I am in full black garb,
you're going
not
back.
A clerical collar.
No. I want to know, first of all, what would possess a person to decide to train as a priest?
Really good question. You'd think after all these years I'd have a down pat answer, but I still don't. Maybe I could phrase it in two ways. One is it's a role of service, and anyone who knows me, that's been my life to date. Just about everything I've ever done, including Parliament, is service. I enjoy or find fulfillment, is that the right word, in helping others. But then there is a religious or spiritual element to this. We often talk about it as a calling, and it's something very difficult, Rodney, to explain to anyone, because it's not like a literal voice, you know. God doesn't pick up the cell phone and give you a call. But in my case, coming back from university lectures, so I was 18, coming back from lectures, I was enjoying first year, and underline and italicized the word enjoying university life, and had an almighty sense to pray, which is somewhat unusual, even though I was a practicing Catholic in the middle of the day, and long and short, felt this almighty, I don't know, call, sense, that priesthood is something I should explore.
Wow.
And so I did.
And that wasn't in you before that moment?
No, not really. I mean, I'm a classic Catholic. I mean, born and raised in the Catholic family and went to Catholic schools and was an altar server and all of that. But I wasn't thinking about priesthood when I was 16, going on 17 when I left for uni. I was more thinking whether I'd actually join the military, believe it or not, or anything else. I hadn't thought about priesthood. So this sort of came out of the blue. But that was sort of the start of the journey there.
And when you say that was the start of the journey, how long from what did you do and how long from there before you entered, what is it? What do you call it? Priest school?
Priest school, yeah. Well, good. A priest school for priests. Now, they call it seminary.
Seminary. So how long before you had to go through a process to get accepted into the seminary and you had to decide to go, this is it? How long did that take before you went to the seminary from that moment?
It was only 9 months, actually. So around about 9 months. It was early on in the year. So got in contact with some priest friends who then put me in contact with others. And you do a little bit of discussion and discernment. And so in 1995, I think it was, start of 95, I went into the seminary. So it was a fairly short, not rushed, but
yes.
The real discernment starts by going into the seminary.
Yes, but of course the church would know you because you weren't walking off the street. You'd been attending church, your family, and so it's not like you were a stranger to them.
No, and look, to be fair on them, the church has learned a lot through various scandals and so forth, but these days a lot of assessments done before you go in. So everything from physical health to a whole lot of psychological tests and examinations, obviously reference checks and so forth. Mm. It doesn't make it right or perfect, but they do quite a lot of background checking before you even start the seminary life.
I'm sure you get asked this question, but not on radio. these days, it's sort of taught to us that we are, what's the word, given over to our passions. We can't deny our passions. We can't deny our sexual desire. And that poor 15-year-olds, they can't just stop themselves. So, understand this. You've got to teach them all this, probably younger. And, they've got to have abortions because you can't stop yourself. But here you were, a young man, making a decision to be celibate, which in this day and age is incomprehensible to people.
Yeah, it's funny. So you take three vows, poverty, which is self-explanatory, obedience, which I might come back to, actually strictly chastity, which means you, without being too heavy on a radio show, just means you're going to sort of order or structure your sexual life. And actually, we're all called to it, believe it or not. If you're married, you're meant to stay with one person.
Yes.
And as a priest, you are to remain single or celibate. So it's not easy. You're still human. You're still a sexual creature. But you're also human. You have a brain. You have a mind. You have an ability. You have a will. And so you try to order things and structure things. But it's not as if you end up in some ethereal, amazing world where life is easy. It's still a hell of a struggle. But I used to joke, but it had a serious side. Of the three vows, it was obedience. I found the most difficult. So while my political leaders found me troublesome, if you were to pull in my what they called superiors, my priestly superiors, they would tell you I was also a problem with them, with always questioning of why something had to be the way it was.
Yeah. I find this extraordinary. I remember being a young man, oh boy, and scared stiff that something would happen to me and I'd die a virgin.
Oh God.
Right? Really? And because we're living in a sex-soaked world, to me. And I mean, I don't know how to separate it out the environment that I grew up in, which was not as soaked as it is now. But it sort of was important. And if someone had come to me at 18 and say, oh, that sex thing, yeah, and I'm quite looking forward to that. No. You're going to not have that sex thing. Oh, okay. I'd find that a little off-putting.
It's challenging. I sort of want to stress to your listeners, it's not as if somehow, choosing to become a priest that whole side disappears and it becomes easy. You know, we're still very human. A lot of the people I trained with left because they fell in love, yes, amongst other reasons. But it's also a very fulfilling life in other ways. It's, again, I just use the analogy. When someone gets married, you've made your decision to commit to that one person. You're being called to a chastity there as well. So it's, in some ways, it's not different. But the great irony, if I might, having gone from spending pretty much all my 20s training as a priest, so yes, poor and celibate and supposedly obedient, God has a sense of humor, and that once I got into Parliament, I met my now wife and have gone from that single monastic life to married with five stepchildren.
I know.
And foster children.
Amazing. Tell me, what do you do in a seminary? Like, I understand school and university. What's a seminary like?
So think about it as built around a lot of prayer and reflective time. So is, if you will, you wake quite early in the morning, 4, 5 a.m. There's prayers, so formal prayers, where obviously, you know, someone says something, you respond. So what you see in movies, the monastic, people saying prayers and all that carry on, and then a lot of just time to quietly pray. And that goes all through the day. You've got in the morning, can be in the middle of the day, the evening, at night before you head to bed. But then all around that, if you will, prayerful spiritual life is the academic side, which we briefly touched on. So in my days, we went to Auckland University and studied philosophy and theology and various languages. And then on top of that, what you'd call the pastoral experiences. So that's the, you know, the practical side. So we lived near Ponsonby Road and K Road. So you got to know most of the ladies and men of the night and talk with them in the best of ways, I better add to your listeners. You know, working in homeless shelters, hospitals, you mentioned the military. I spent some time at the old Mount Eden prison, years overseas. So you're doing a lot of practical work of helping people as well. So yeah, think about it as three pillars: prayer, the academics, and then that pastoral experiential side.
It would have been quite an amazing experience.
Oh, I loved it. It was not for me. A little bit like what's happening with politics. I enjoyed being in the seminary. I felt that's what I was meant to be doing. But I don't regret leaving for a day. And I've never been back. But I don't regret it for a day. And I don't regret the training. It's made me the man I am today.
How many years were you in the seminary?
About 9 years.
My goodness.
So,
And presumably you learn Latin?
Yeah, we did Latin, Greek, Māori, English, of course, but I did French. And probably my best language is Fijian, because I was sent to Fiji for 2 years. So when I'm on the marae, doing my mihi whakato or a little talk, I tend to start in Maori and end up in Fijian, which confuses all the kamata and kuya these days. But anyway.
And your Maori is quite good. Your Maori is quite good.
I can understand it. So when Calvin Davis and friends were speaking in the parliament, I could usually understand what they were talking about, even if they didn't. sorry, Calvin. No, but I could understand it mostly, but my ability to speak it now is really getting challenged. I just, like any language, Rodney, if you're not using it all the time, same with my Fijian too, it's getting very rusty.
And Latin is would be great to learn.
I loved learning it. It was a real challenge. You obviously more read Latin than speak it. But I particularly found, for me, learning Latin was great for my English, as then you begin to realize where the words and etymology of so much comes from.
And the grammar.
And the grammar.
Yep. And this, because all of the vocabulary and grammar, it sort of references back to Latin, I think.
It also worked out very well on our honeymoon, because we went, amongst other places, to Rome. And so I was able to read, obviously, everything from the mass or but when you're going around in the back streets of Rome, as Rachel and I preferred to do, keep away from the tourist spots, could spot the churches. They're not like New Zealand, they're just doors, but you could see the inscriptions and Yeah, it was a great language to learn.
You didn't turn to your wife and say, "There's the Pope, there's the Pope." If it wasn't for you, that could be me.
No. Although, fortunately, I didn't leave. Unusually, I left the seminary because I just realized it wasn't for me. And to be honest, part of it was becoming quite political, and you shouldn't be politician and priest. So I wasn't one of the ones who left because of relationship, but we did end up with going to the midnight mass at Christmas. But Rachel and I would just very casually, I think jeans and T-shirts and warm jackets, like incredibly casual because it's freezing cold at that time of year. But we queued up for hours and hours and hours. Then I handed over the tickets that I had got through the papal ambassador. Well, the Swiss guard basically clicks to attention, takes us right down the middle of St. Peter's Basilica and sits us with all the ambassadors sitting there in their white tie and breast stars and sashes and medals. And here I am in a Boston Red Sox caps and a pair of jeans, basically almost in front of the Pope. And it's like, where are you from? It's like, Australia. But
was it a hard decision to come to after 9 years to leave? Because like that's what you knew, all you knew.
What a wonderful question, wonderfully phrased. Because often I say to people, it's an easy decision to make, but a hard decision to get to. So, in what was my last year, I'd just come back from Fiji. I was on fire, not literally, but was ready to go. But what turned out to be my last year, I became increasingly agitated for various reasons. And but trying to work out to leave, partly because, yeah, it's a life you'd known. Become your little family. It's a routine you're familiar with. Add the spiritual element into it. You're going, hold on a moment. Am I making the right decision? And what is going to be the consequences? So it was a very, very difficult decision. But I remember writing to my superiors at the end of the year, but I better be clear, not a list of demands, but just a couple of things that I was saying, look, you know, I want to be in a community that prays together and a few other things. And when I got the response, I knew that's it. It's not.
Because not had the church changed in that time?
I think it changed. I had probably changed as well, to be fair. It was, again, wonderful to be in seminary, but it was a very changing time. Without getting too heavy, Rodney, this was, you know, when a lot of the scandals were occurring. Mm. And so you have not only challenges in the outside world who thinks most of the people in a seminary or priest should be arrested, through to also, you know, a church trying to work out its identity. So it was a challenging time. But, yeah, the long and the short, it was a hard decision to get to. But once I made the decision, it was swift and relatively
easy. How did
easy.
Your mentors who'd followed you and guided you for 9 years, how did they react?
Well, some were sad and disappointed, and part of that would be that, you know, they'd invest a lot of time. I was about to be ordained, basically. But for others, I think they saw the writing on the wall. I think in leaving, in the subsequent months, I got a bit more clarity of myself. And what I mean by that is friends and family, like my own parents, like, yeah, we knew you were going to leave. You were just so frustrated and angry. I was like, really? I didn't think I was. But then I began to realize I didn't have a clear perception of self. And it was the same with some of my what they call formators or superiors. I don't think they were completely surprised. They were seeing a young or youngish man who was just not happy and content. But it took me a little while to click to that.
You must know the Bible well.
Well, I was going to make a joke that I'm Catholic and therefore I don't, but that would be unfortunate. I'll get you a whole series of complaints now. No, but I know it.
Catholics have got the best jokes.
My wife, who's Baptist, would know it much, much better. She's aghast at times, Rodney. She can quote chapter and verse, and I go, oh, there was somewhere in the New Testament it says this. But no, I did a lot of scripture. It's one of my majors, believe it or not, at university. So I know the Bible relatively well, but I'm not a chapter and verse type guy.
Is it the Word of God?
It is, yeah. It's the inspired word of God. And why I use that is, and this is one of the tensions between, say, the Catholic and Orthodox churches and the Protestant, or elements of the Protestant churches. We don't believe it's the absolute literal word of God in every sentence, but all of it's inspired by God. So it's that tension between inspired and is it literal? And so in my case, I'm not a literalist. There are elements in the Bible which are metaphorical or symbolic. And so that's been 2,000 years of challenge of and debate theologically of, yeah, what's to be absolute gospel truth, no pun intended, and what's meant to be, a metaphor.
Because that allows you, once you say it's not literal, you pick and choose.
And of course, you can do.
And then, of course, if it's literal, there's some tough bits in it.
Oh, very much so. I mean, if I had to go exceptionally broad, you know, when you're in more of the New Testament, so your Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John's, it's much more, if you will, literal. Mm. But not in every case, you know. I'm showing my lack of chapter and verse, but, you know, there's a point where, you know, Jesus talks about cutting off one's hand to stop one sinning. Well, I think a lot of us would be handless if that was the case. So
yes.
I would argue, let's not take that literally. And certainly a lot of the Old Testament too, I would suggest you wouldn't want to take literally. But it's about, for me personally, it's about stepping back and going, what's the deeper message here? And look,
and so,
again, without...
Yes, and so the view would be that this was written by men who were inspired by God to write what they wrote.
Yeah, that's the general... In particularly Catholic position, it's the inspired word of God. And then, but there's a hierarchy in that, because you wouldn't be Catholic if there wasn't a hierarchy. Again, things like the Gospels would have a much higher, if you will, literal content to them. Mm. But again, that's been 2,000 years of discussion and debate, and why there are libraries filled with exegetical or deep discussions. Yes. On what the meaning of that are.
But it's a great discipline.
Oh, it's why we did Latin and yes. Greek. You would sit with books where you'd literally have columns. So you'd have the English, then the Greek, the Latin, and then perhaps other languages. Sometimes you'd have the original Aramaic. Not that I studied that at depth, but you were looking at what do the words mean. Because that's the other complication, without getting too yes. theological on people, is we're reading in English.
Yes.
Which came from a Latin text, which came from a Greek text, which came from Aramaic text. So all these Aramaic, sorry. So it's complicated.
And presumably copied and copied and copied over and over with transcription errors.
Exactly right. Exactly right. Although, again, we don't want to, and I'm not suggesting you're saying this, but there are some who want to sort of then throw out the quality of the text in its entirety, because there could have been a transcription error by an Irish monk in the 11th century. Yes. But we have so many texts, so many to refer to, that we have some relative certainties. But
no, well, I've started becoming a newly minted Christian. I've started reading the Bible, and I must say I love it. And the power of it, and also how it's deep within us culturally.
Mm.
Because the bit I like, there's so much I like about the church, but it's that conservative thing that, as Bill English described it to me once, it's very good to have something that's been around longer than governments, you know, that you
yes.
belong to, that it puts government in perspective. Whereas if you're a lefty socialist atheist, government is the be all and end all of everything. And if the government decides that such and such is the truth and such is going to happen, you have to nod your head and go along with it. And to have that higher authority and that length of time puts perspective even on government.
Absolutely.
I think it's very powerful for a Christian to have.
Well, I think it's a sense there's always something bigger than you. And, yes. you know, you could, even just for argument's sake, you could remove Christianity per se and put in another religion as such, and better be clear to your listeners, not here arguing to replace Christianity, but more that sense of something you're higher than just simply oneself. And it's why, personally, in the Parliament, I used to light the prayer at the start. Yes. It was a reminder there's something much, much bigger.
Me too.
And also, as a staunch monarchist, and again, I better be clear here, not putting the king above God, but actually swearing an oath to the king, to the crown, was also a reminder to me that there's more than just simply me in the Parliament. There is something bigger, but that spiritual side or that sense of transcendent is essentially important.
And those wreaths around the Parliament.
Yes.
Of the battles where men have fought and died. It's And that's the power of Parliament, because it wasn't just that they fought and died, it was our Parliament sent them there to fight and die.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I think that as a newly minted Christian, not knowing much, I think it's very important to believe that there's something bigger than you. Otherwise, you're just a ego, narcissist, pleasure-seeking bunch of cells. It just strikes me as peculiar. But once you see it, it sort of quite shocks you how much about the self we can become. And maybe that's why humans can't avoid having a belief structure. Like, you can't not believe in something, can you?
Look, exactly right. And I think it's at the heart of what some people would call the culture wars at the moment. Either you do believe in something bigger than yourself, or, to use the word you just used, a narcissism. And we're seeing that much more and more now, particularly around identity politics and the like, that the only high value is oneself. And ironically, but not unexpectedly, when you have a bunch of narcissists running around, things end very violently, be that in language or physically, because a whole lot of egos and selves crash into one another. There isn't a sense of anything bigger.
I hadn't quite seen that before, and I can see that now. And of course, that's how our children are being brought up.
Oh, yeah. Well, you want to inculcate to your children there is something bigger than themselves. I mean, the first thing they need to understand, and I always say this to people, you're born into relationship. You are never by yourself. You are always born into relationship. You are son to mother, son to father. You're always, from the moment of your conception, in relationship. And so, by the way, I don't say this to the young, my young stepkids. It's like, that's far too philosophical. But the sense is, there is something bigger than just you. There's your family. Then there's your friends. Then there's the community. But we are seen, unfortunately, now, and again, identity politics writes at large, it's just so self-absorbed, and it's no surprise that it ends in conflict, the race to the bottom of who's the greater victim. And then the outright violence that you've seen, sadly, actually in recent weeks with various protests and then the Posey Parker attacks last year, it begets violence. And that's the other thing, if I might, Rodney, the history of the church, we've been here before. It's a cycle. We've seen it all before.
Do you see it as a battle between Satan and God?
Sitting in a theological context, yes. So hard to get the nuances across, perhaps in a radio interview, because we're not just little puppets down here on Earth, and there's some great, in my mind, some great big cosmic battle where we're just being pushed around. But certainly it's in the Orthodox Christian tradition that actually there is this spiritual battle between good and evil, and that somewhat captures us here in the world.
But you feel it in your own self, don't you?
Oh, I think a lot of us, we do. There is that tension. I mean, it's a funny thing about human nature. We can do all the best things in the world, but we also find ourselves being pulled in what we know at times to be the wrong direction, yet we do it.
Mm. Yeah. I went and had that chocolate bar.
That's right, old bars.
But you can't imagine, I mean, the COVID experience partly, dobbing in neighbours, but those tough times in history, you know, where hard, hard choices were made by people, and it was good versus evil. And very easy to choose evil if it's the path of least resistance sort of thing. You know, you're living in Germany and you say, look, I got my kids at school. I just, you know, I don't want to be shot. You know, all these sorts of things. It's extraordinary. Simon, you illustrate for our listeners, I'm sure, that our parliament isn't a meritocracy, because if it was, you would still be there, because you've got a lot to contribute to us. And you've got a lot of experience and wisdom and insight that the average MP is an empty space. I was very disappointed to see you gone from our parliament. Very disappointed. And I was appalled that I don't mind people voting and they can choose their MP, but I was appalled by the ACT Party, my party, my former party, putting up a candidate against you when I regarded you as a great ally for our cause. And I didn't like the campaign being framed against you. So I want to apologize for that. But also I feel as though we've had a great loss in our parliament.
Well, it's very kind of you to say. It was a pretty nasty campaign, and one that was very much targeted because of my value system. But in a strange way, Rodney, I find that that's good that's been outed. Actually, it's good it was so explicit, so people can go, oh, gosh, and then they can make their decisions. But a little bit like where we started. I'm a great believer in different seasons. In other words, there's no regrets, no resentments. I'm sort of like, okay, literally 8:15 on election night, said to Rachel, we're done.
That is a seasons is a biblical quote.
It is. See, I can pull out a biblical quote every so often.
well, even I can. Simon, lovely to talk. I would like to think you'd come back on the show. That was just throat clearing for who you are and what you've been. But I'd love to know, it seems to me you've got an extraordinary amount to offer because of your training and your background. And I know that you'll go on to bigger and better things and do even bigger service than you could have done, constrained as you were in Parliament. And I think it's wonderful that you can take that parliamentary experience, take that seminary experience, and now be yourself.
Well, it's one of the paradoxes I've put to friends and families, that you'd expect you go into Parliament to be the freest and most open, you know, that whole privilege we talk about, parliamentary privilege. But the irony is that in leaving Parliament, I'm freer to speak than I was when I was in.
Yes, you're great. And with us, you've got a platform. There you are. We're on Reality Check Radio, Real Talk with Rodney Hyde. I've been having the most fascinating and insightful discussion with Simon O'Connor, who's an amazing man with a lot of experiences and who has thought long and hard about the deep questions of what it is to be human, but hasn't done that in an ethereal place. And as we learned today, he's done it in a place where you're down K Road, dealing with people that we just drive past and look at. And Simon has been there talking to them. He's been to Fiji, speaking to the downtrodden and the dispossessed and into the military, and being a parliamentarian. So he's been within the halls of power. So truly, truly wonderful. Remember, you can send me a text at 2057. You can email me at inbox@radleycheck.radio, and please do. And let me know what you're thinking. Let me know what we're doing wrong. Let me know what we're doing right. Let me know what we should be doing. Thank you for listening.
With your help, we can continue to fight for freedom. This is not possible without your generosity. Join our quest for the truth and our freedom by simply visiting www.realitycheck.radio/donate to make a difference today.